Good morning, church. If you can be turning to 1 Samuel, chapters 22 and 23, we are still in the midst here of David's time of being a refugee, essentially because of King Saul's jealousy, which led him to several attempts on David's life. And the reason for that is because David's God-given courage and skill had brought him such great success. And that in turn brought widespread popularity amongst the people. And consequently for Saul, as we saw last week when John expounded the earlier chapters to us, Saul's delight and joy in David turned to fear and suspicion and eventually to attempted murder. Saul had become paranoid and he now considered David to be a dangerous rival to his throne. So, consequently, David was forced into becoming a fugitive from injustice. And he is going from one place to another in the wilderness of Ziph, which is about 30 miles south of Jerusalem. He's just trying to stay out of Saul's way. And he was joined, according to chapter 22 and verse 2, by a group of people who were marginalized in Saul's kingdom. They were probably people who had been loyal to David, and they may well have been, some of them, militarily proficient people. They could well have been part of a group of 100, of 1,000 or so soldiers that David had led when he was working for Saul. And chapter 22 begins with David and his motley bunch of hangers-on holed up in a place called the Cave of Adullam. It is a far cry from his father's sheep fields. But it is here that David sought refuge from his enemies, because Saul and his troops are in hot pursuit, and the situation is not looking good. I think of all the days of David before he became king over Israel, these must have been some of his darkest days. I don't think I'm reading too much into the text in saying that David's spirits at this point are at an all-time low. David is now Israel's most wanted man, guilty of nothing more than faithfully serving God and his king. In chapter 22, it describes how David flees to Ahimelech, the high priest, who gives him some sacred bread and the sword of Goliath. But that actually results in Saul committing a wholesale slaughter of Ahimelech, his priests, and their families, all due to the totally wrong assumption that Ahimelech and the priests have joined with David in a conspiracy. So the hunt for David is intensifying. And David knew it. His life was on the line. And his confidence was slipping. Saul was concerned with one thing: killing the man who he knew would one day take his place. Maybe you felt like David at times. pursued by an adversary of doubt, of fear, of hopelessness, and rejection. All of which tempt you into giving up, tossing in the towel of life and running to a cave of mere existence. And in those circumstances, the temptation is always to play safe, isn't it? Which is why, when David hears in chapter 23 that the people of Keilah are being attacked by the Philistines, he finds himself in a bit of a quandary. He wants to go to their rescue, but King Saul is still threatening his life. And if David exposes his location by fighting the Philistines, he then makes himself an open target for Saul. What do you do when you don't know what to do? Hopefully, the answer is that you seek God's will in the matter. Well, David asks God what to do, and he receives an assurance that he would have success against the Philistines. But David's men with him are not so sure. Their confidence was on the verge of being broken. Their hope was virtually extinguished. At a time when we'd expect God perhaps to have mercy on these men by giving them a commission which was soft and appealing, he sends them straight into a battle that requires a great deal of physical and emotional strength. Instead of allowing them to roll over and pull the duvet over their heads, they were being called to go to war on behalf of a country that had all but forgotten them. So you can probably understand David's hesitation. Perhaps you know what it's like to be hotly pursued by the enemy. You may have been betrayed, forgotten, ridiculed. And maybe here you can identify with David's fear, frustration, and sorrow. And you feel that the stresses of this life are threatening to stretch you past breaking point. But God seems to be pushing you to get back up and get into again doing what he'd given you to do. Well, David learned a lesson here that changed his life, and it will change yours as well. And it's this: there is never a moment when you are outside of God's care. He is sovereign, and the enemy cannot touch you apart from the will of God. And sorrow and disappointment and a sense of betrayal needn't prevent you from living your life for the Lord, because God is working on your behalf, just as he was with David. And yet it seems that no matter what David does, things get worse. He rescues this village of Keilah from the Philistines, only to find out that the very people he has rescued are quite willing to betray David and his men into the hands of Saul. Total betrayal. And so David ends up running from Saul all over again. Now, why did God allow David to face such opposition and betrayal? He was the anointed king. He was God's choice. He was a man after God's own heart, we're told, in Acts chapter 13. Many times, it seems to me, God places us in a furnace of affliction so that we will learn to trust him in an even greater way. He refines our faith by allowing us to face opposition and even failure. And there will be times when you want to give up, when the pressures of life will just grow to a point where you just want to lie down in defeat. You've had enough. But God doesn't want you to sink into despair. We may not understand all the aspects of the challenges or the problems that we're facing. And we may try and imagine how God's provision will come about, especially when we're facing a desperate situation such as a layoff at work or the death of a loved one. But we can learn to trust God and leave the outcome to him. And this is what David had to learn. We know what David was feeling emotionally because he wrote a number of psalms during this period of his life. Psalm 27 is one of them. And it speaks of David's sense of loneliness, his fear of his enemies, his sense of discouragement, and his desire for God to vindicate him. And there's further Psalms 52 to 59, also give you a flavour of how he was feeling at this time. And I think any of us would be discouraged if we were in David's shoes. You serve God, you do the best you can, you risk your life to help others who then betray you, and all you get for your trouble is more trouble. But here's the thing. God knows how to send help at the very point where we need it desperately. At precisely the right time, God sends a precious friend to help David. Jonathan, Saul's son, is David's closest friend. And when he hears that David is in the wilderness of Ziph, he goes down to help him find strength in God. See that in verse 16, chapter 23. It's fascinating, isn't it? Saul is roaming around trying to find David and can't. Jonathan apparently has no problem at all. The text doesn't tell us how Jonathan knew where to find David. But that's how God orchestrates things, isn't it? And Jonathan brings help in the form of a crucially important ministry of encouragement. When I was in the military, there were two units that played a key role with regard to morale. There was the psychological operations unit, whose job was to sabotage the morale of the enemy. And there was the chaplain's corps, whose task in the eyes of the military chiefs was to keep the army's morale high. And in the Bible, you know, the Christian is often compared to being a soldier. The church is compared to being an army, because we are in a spiritual battle in which the devil attacks the Christian with doubt, with fear, with betrayal, with discouragement, and with depression. And our morale can plummet, which makes the ministry of encouragement so important. But it's one which is so often neglected within the church. So let me spend a little bit of time this morning talking about what Jonathan was doing here with David. You see, the ministry of encouragement is not just giving you a pat on the back and saying, oh, well, you did that very well, or don't worry, it'll be fine, just hang in there, you'll be okay. That's important, I'm not knocking that. But a Christian ministry of encouragement goes deeper. It's knowing how to direct a person's attention and focus onto God and his promises. And in Jonathan, we are actually going to see a glimpse of Jesus. Because I don't want you to miss the sacrifice that's involved in Jonathan's commitment to David in friendship here. Ask yourself, if you will, what would have been Jonathan's natural desire for his own future? I don't think we have to delve too far for the answer. His father is the king. He is the prince. He is next in line to the king. The natural desire that Jonathan would have would be to succeed his father as king over all Israel. Right? But what did he say he believed God's will was for his future? If you look at verse 17, he says to David, you shall be king over Israel, and I will be second to you. Jonathan, this faithful man of God, was convinced that God was calling him to be second. And he had no hesitation about that. He had no problem with that. He was quite content with the fact that God was calling him to be in second place, when actually he had a royal right by succession to be in first place. If you think back over your own life, your own dreams and ambitions that you seek from God, it's very rare, isn't it, that we feel that God is calling us to be in second place. Usually we feel that God is calling us to a promotion. God is calling us to be a leader. God is calling us to be the manager. God is calling us to be the head and not the tail. We think of God calling us to be in first place. And yet if it's true that God has called all of his children to different areas and to different functions, he has to be calling some to be in second place, surely. And why not me? Perhaps God has called me not to be the leader, not to be the chief speaker, but to be the Barnabas. You remember in the book of Acts? It talks about Paul and Barnabas going to a city, and they call Barnabas a name, referring to a Greek god, and they call Barnabas another name. But the reason that they called Paul Hermes was because it says he was the chief speaker. Think about that for a moment. Barnabas was the second person. He was the helper. And yet earlier on in the book of Acts, Barnabas starts out as the prominent leader. Barnabas is the one who brought Paul to the apostles in the first place when they wouldn't receive him because they were suspicious of him. Barnabas was the one who convinced them that Paul indeed was a new converted man, that he had a genuine experience of the Lord. And yet here we are, now Barnabas is content to be like Jonathan in being second to Paul. Why isn't it that I should feel God calling me to be a Barnabas? Why do I not feel that God may be calling me to be a Shadrach, Meshach, or Abednego? Why do I always have to be the Daniel? Why is it not that God doesn't call me to perhaps be a Shadrach? When we look through the Bible, there are instances both in the Old Testament and in the New Testament, like those I mentioned, where God is calling people to be in a role of support for another Christian, for another follower of God, another believer. And whilst I'm not saying that you're not called to be a leader, we should at least consider, at least entertain the possibility that maybe God is calling you or equipping you, preparing you to be a support to someone else's ministry, to be the helper. And this is not in any way a less noble position. This is not in any way less glorious or in any way less a calling of God than when God calls David to be king, or God calls Daniel to high office, or God calls Paul to be the chief apostle to the Gentiles. But that's Jonathan's mindset. He's willing to be second. Now, very briefly, let me run through five aspects to Jonathan's encouragement of David, all of which point us to Jesus. First of all, there is an appeal to be free from fear. In verse 17, Jonathan says, "Don't be afraid." Do you remember how frequently Jesus used to say those words? The fact is, God never wants us to be fearful of anything except the possibility of drifting out of fellowship with him. No other fear should ever have license to take root in a Christian's life. In Isaiah chapter 8, verse 13, God says to us, "Let the Lord of hosts be your fear." And then you don't have to fear anything else. Jonathan knew something of this. He knew that David was likely tempted to be afraid, because with all of Saul's resources, it would seem virtually impossible for David to escape from his grasp. The future looked bleak. His circumstances were painful. David had made some big mistakes. And Jonathan knew that fear ran the risk of extinguishing David's faith. But he also knows that it works the other way round. And so he urges David to let faith cast out fear. That's the first encouragement. But secondly, there is an assurance of continual rescue. Jonathan says, "My father Saul will not lay a hand on you." David had been rescued from Saul before, and he needs to know that what he's experienced so far is going to continue all the time. God will go on rescuing him. He can just accept the fact and relax in the confidence that God will always be there when Saul is at hand with his threats, because God has promises to fulfill. You know, often I think we experience God's miraculous preservation in something, but we somehow think that we have been rescued just this once. We need to know that God's rescues will continue. In 2 Corinthians chapter 1, Paul spoke about the time where he was once unbearably crushed, and he was then delivered. But the deliverance was intended so that Paul could set his hope on the fact that, as he put it, he who has rescued us will continue to rescue us. And that he might know that he will rescue us yet again. 2 Corinthians 1 verse 10. God's deliverances are not one-off incidents, but lifelong faithfulness. And David must learn to believe in and to find relief and refreshment in the truth of that. Saul will never succeed. Then, thirdly, Jonathan gives David an assurance concerning the future. Jonathan says, "You shall be king over Israel, and I will be second to you." If David is God's choice for Israel's next king, then nothing and no one, including King Saul, will be able to kill him or thwart God's purposes and promises. Jonathan's assurance of this is rooted in the sovereignty of God, who will bring his purposes to pass. And this is a reminder which we need again and again and again. Because one conflict I think we often have in the life of faith is coping with dark forebodings about the future. But David has got a good future, both in general terms, that God will be with him, but in particular as well, that God's precise plans will come about. And any doubts that he might have concerning Jonathan are also answered, because Jonathan says, "I shall be second to you," which assures David that Jonathan is not making any claims himself upon the throne. And in fact, he'll have Jonathan's active support. God wants us to feel totally safe concerning the future. Nothing will happen to us that is not within his control. Fourthly, there is an assurance that his enemy already knows his defeat. Jonathan says, "My father Saul knows that this is so." Despite all his opposition to David, Saul knew his defeat. and others knew that he knew. But opposition to God's kingdom is never reasonable. Hatred kept Saul going, even when he knew there was no hope of success. His hope that God was on his side was purely wishful thinking. And like the devil, Saul knew that his time was short. The very violence of Saul was kicking against the goads, like another Saul, many years later. And Jonathan wants David to see that total victory is virtually a present possession. Nothing more is needed than steady persistence in faith, keeping watchful, and observing how God's victory inevitably and irresistibly takes effect. And the Christian is in precisely this situation. Jesus is already the King of Kings. Soon every knee will bow and every tongue confess that he is Lord. By faith we know it now. And in his heart the devil knows it already. And the promise of Scripture in Romans chapter 16 is the God of peace will crush Satan under your feet shortly. Finally, we have an assurance of covenant friendship. We read that in verse 18, then the two of them made a covenant before the Lord. A covenant was a promise which was made more secure by the taking of a solemn oath. And Jonathan is like Jesus to David. He swears never to leave him nor forsake him. He has nothing but goodwill towards him. But Jonathan was like Jesus in another way too. His friendship with David cost him a great deal. For David, he laid down his rights to a throne that was rightfully his. And eventually, in the midst of doing God's will, he laid down his own life. And David became ruler as a result. And I'd like you to think this morning of how Jesus, our heavenly Jonathan, also laid aside his royal majesty and was willing to lose everything so that we might be made kings and priests unto God. God called Jesus to go from the top, from the height of heights, not even to be second, not even to be third, but as it says in that wonderful passage in Philippians chapter 2, Jesus came all the way down and was obedient to death, even death on a cross. From the King of Glory he came down, not just to be a human, not even a king amongst humans, but he came and he took on the form of a servant amongst humans. And not even a servant alone, but a servant who was branded as a murderer, a thief, treated as a transgressor, counted with the transgressors and killed as one of them. And Jesus went from the height of heights and came down all the way. Like Jonathan, he too literally laid down his life that we might reign. And yet, unlike Jonathan, he goes on ministering encouragement to us, constantly reminding us that we need not fear. We shall always be finally rescued. That the future is secure. That the devil is defeated. And Jesus is keeping his oath that he will never forsake us. There is no greater encouragement that you could possibly have. I want to conclude to you by reading to you from verse 14. If you've got your own Bible to hand, circle it, underline it, mark it, put an asterisk next to it. It is one of the most significant verses in this passage. Day by day, Saul searched for David, but God did not give David into his hands. Satan is after you and me, every single minute of every day. But as long as you don't fear, as long as you trust in God's rescue, as long as you place your future in God's hands, as long as you stay committed to that covenant relationship God has with you, God will not permit him to touch you. He might tempt you, the devil. He goes on tempting, he goes on trying to entice us. But the Bible says, he can't touch you. And I hope that thought will encourage you this week as you live for him in a hostile world. Let's bow our heads and pray.